You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. So nice to have you with us. I almost wish that this week's guest, we could have had him on about a week ago because it would have been a great tie into Father's Day. But the story itself is still something that resonates all year long with anybody. So no real loss, but the timing, I guess, for Father's Day would have also been a plus, as they say. My guest is author Stephen Eichenblatt. His new book is Pretend They Are Dead, A Father's Search for the Truth. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Stephen Eichenblatt about personal experience. One, not having a relationship or having his blood father in his life, and then a stepfather, again, not, as they say, stepping up to the plate and playing the important role, and the effect that that's had on Stephen over the years, and how he views fathership, being a parent himself, which he put between the pages of a book. And I always say, anybody that's willing to write a personal memoir, more often than not, in fact, every case basically writes from the heart and also writes from emotions that have been stirring within them for so very long. Stephen Eichenblatt, welcome to The Public Eye.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Steve, nice to have you on. Did I stretch it a little bit when I said that when an author or anybody decides to put their personal life, experiences within their personal life between the pages of a book, it's motivated by the experience itself, but the emotions that you feel. And I've heard this in the past, and people say, it was a way of me being able to reconcile everything. I had to get it out, and sometimes talking to people directly is great, but this way it was just me and my computer. And as I was writing, everything just flowed, and it seemed to release something within, and gave me some solace. Is that how you felt?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, definitely. It's cathartic in some ways because it went right from my brain, I guess, through my heart onto the paper. So I would just sit there and write. And sometimes I'd wake up or I would come like the next morning after I wrote a bunch of stuff and I'd look at it and go, oh my gosh, who wrote this stuff? This is really bad. Or I'd look at it and go, this is really good. And I can't believe I even had those feelings because of the way they came out and they went onto the paper. So it's a great therapeutic experience for anybody, no matter what you're going through. I really, not necessarily a whole memoir, but just journaling or just putting stuff down on paper, it helped.
Now, in the book, you mentioned your father, you mentioned your blood father, Alan, who left, at an early age. Was there any relationship prior to that separation, or was it, when you were just too young to even remember it?
He left when I was probably about 6 years old. I had a twin sister and a little brother, and he and my mother got separated at that point, divorced, not sure the exact timing, and then he gave us up for good when we were about eight. So there's a couple of years in there, again, timing's not exact, where he had, there was some visitation, but listen, he wasn't like an all-star father before he left, because he was very much focused on work and developing his veterinary practice. And didn't really know how to be a dad.
Yeah. And then your mom got remarried, right? And the stepfather, unfortunately didn't play much of a role as a father either, or a father figure.
I call it the book, The Brady Bunch from Hell. He was a stern disciplinarian and with little upside. So he was mean, but he wasn't, like, in contrast, he wasn't really very nice. So there was a lot of rules that were imposed on us that were totally foreign to me. He moved in the house with his four kids, and we were kind of thrown together in one family, and from the outside told you were going to be a happy family and to forget anything that happened, in the past. So it was a really difficult, it was like living in a house of minefields where you weren't sure, from one day to the next, who they're going to get, or what you did wrong or whether you're going to break the rule. It was just very high anxiety from a really young age.
Yeah, and you know, Steve, and I think you'd agree with this, probably more so than most people because you live through it. You know that part of the role of a parent, especially now you are a parent yourself, that you want to be a friend, but you've also got to be able to set some guidelines. You've got to be able to keep law, for lack of a better term, rules and regulations, so there's not chaos within the family, especially if there's more than one child. You've got additional siblings. But when it's one extreme or the other, and in this case, one was abandonment. Secondly, the stepfather steps in and doesn't play the role, as you said, a disciplinarian, someone that probably had an unpleasant demeanor. So throughout your early age, and I think it's, we hear this time and time again, those formative years, if you will, are left with a void, right?
Yeah, I mean, there was void in one sense, and then there was, there was an overdose of emotional pain because he really was... he's just a mean guy. And when he moved in the house and we moved in that, he showed up and there's all of a sudden we have seven children and a new father in this small, small house, middle-class house. And we were told, can't walk in the front door anymore. Can't sit on the furniture. You can't eat meals with your parents. You're not allowed in the kitchen. I mean, he imposed all these very, very draconian rules and there were punishments, physical and emotional, that are attached if you broke any of those rules. So I went from being a kid that had lots of friends who would come over the house to a kid who got isolated because none of my friends wanted to come to the house because they didn't want to be around him because he was just me.
How was your mom's reaction to that? Did she step in or did she take a more passive role?
I think, for her, it was really difficult because all of a sudden she had seven children to take care of instead of three. And some of the kids, there was seven of us. And the youngest one was two or three, still in diapers. And so my mom was focused on trying to take care of everybody and a man in her house that within 30 days she knew she should not have married. She did not focus as much attention on maybe me or my twin sister or brother as she might have otherwise.
Yeah, and people say, well, why couldn't she have done more? But you know what? That's overwhelming. It's one thing to have your own children, but now you've got to make a major life adjustment with new children, stepchildren coming into the family. And today it's more common, I think, than any other time in history, as they say, the blended family. So I guess what it comes down to is that you would hope that during this period of adjustment that you've got two strong, a mom and a dad role model who set examples, but at the same time can be compassionate, can be kind. As I said earlier, still have to, put some rules in place. Unfortunately for you, it was a double whammy. Your father leaves first, leaving a void, and then the stepfather steps in, and he's not playing the role at all. Did you ever get to a point where you just said, "Look, I just want to walk away from all of this"?
I did like later on. I mean, when you're 6 or 8 years old and your father disappears and then, this new man comes in, you just kind of accept what you're given at that point because that's just like our regular life. Everybody's born into different situations. We don't know what goes on next door when the door is closed at night, but in our house, you just kind of, this is the norm. The norm is you can't sit on the furniture. You might get physically abused or emotionally abused. It just it became the norm for me, and it really wasn't until later where I started rebelling when it got to be too intense. And my father, even though he lived in the same town, my biological father, and lived within a couple miles, he just dropped us off and never came back.
Hmm. That in itself is chilling. I want to just take a quick pause to remind our listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. I'm Al Voner. This is this week's edition of The Public Eye. My guest this week is author Stephen Eichenblatt. His new book, Pretend They Are Dead, A Father's Search for the Truth. Stephen's life early on was met with some truly challenging milestones. One is his blood father. Biological father left at an early age, not wanting and not having any contact with his children, and then a stepfather who did not play the role as we would assume in being a compassionate, understanding, loving individual. Steve, let me go back for the moment to your father, Alan. So he just walks out, living within the same, as you said, the same town, but yet not having any contact. Did you ever get a sense that he just, that it was overload, that he couldn't deal with it? I hate to say lack of love. I mean, it's almost unfathomable, but somebody could not love their own children and just walks away. So did it maybe appear to be overwhelming for him?
I think at some point it did. I mean, I was pretty young, but it got to that. I was the kid that would be like waiting outside the curb for his father to come pick me up, and he wouldn't show up, or he was supposed to maybe pick me up from baseball practice or running practice, and he should be sitting there waiting with me, waiting, you know, isn't your father coming? And so it got overwhelming, and he just sort of stopped showing up until he just never came back. I mean, come on, man, the guy lives in the same, not just lived in the same town, but he worked in the same town, and it's called the T-Bowl Shopping Center. And we regularly went into that shopping center. But when you're a kid, you just accept, okay, you're not allowed to see him, or you're not going to go knock on the door. And I'm not even sure I wanted to when I was young. I just, this is my new family. And by the way, he is not my stepfather because he adopted me. He is my father. And because he's on my birth certificate, Richard, my the man that my mother married, and we all changed our last names, and we had one last name, and so we were a family, and anything else in the past was ancient history.
Yeah. Did Alan, your biological father, did he get remarried? Did he start another family, or just never? He did. Okay.
He did. He did get married years later. I found out that he got married and he had a couple other children. Hmm. So I had half brothers and half sisters that I met. I did meet later on in my life.
Again, as I said from the outset, it's got to have weighed, and basically you've said it. Yeah, you've said it, that it has weighed on you since you were a young man. But now let's take it to the next level. You have children of your own. You're married. You have children of your own. Was it difficult for you to be a parent, or at least in the role of the father as a parent, the emotions, hugging the children, loving the children, being there for, listening to their stories, listening to their concerns, was that difficult where you didn't see it in your own life?
I think in some ways it was sort of the opposite, where I was too nice as a parent. I was too soft. Like, I was too easy. You know, I was the dad that I had to coach Little League. I had to coach soccer. I had to make sure I was there for everything. I wasn't a yelling, screaming dad, but I was the guy that was sort of on the sidelines, and I just wanted my kids to know I was there, that I was there. My problem, and I think this comes from abandonment and abuse, and I think it's a common male thing, and I think a lot of the women I've spoken with, it's pretty common. Like, I had a lot of trouble, and I still do, with like intimacy, with sharing my feelings with my wife. Probably why I've been married. I'm on my third marriage, but I have a great relationship. And it was just, I focused totally on the kids, but didn't spend enough time learning how to be connected to the women in my life, or even like there was a certain connection that I had lost that was kind of like dead inside. And so it was hard for me. I didn't like to be touched. Even though I like to hug my kids, I was not, even my friends, don't, Steve's not a hugger. Don't touch him. Yeah. It was just that all I know came from what happened, when I was younger. So, but being a parent, I have five kids. I adopted one. My kids call me Wild Steve because I just, I'm a father every day. So that's when you talk about Father's Day early on. I learned, like, as a divorced dad too, you know, every day is special when you're with your kids, and you know, I try to be the best that I can, and I'm definitely not perfect. My kids are probably not perfect.
Oh, there's no, you know, none of us, I don't think, can wear that label, unfortunately. But just the fact that, and I, you know, I do want to fill listeners in a little bit that Steve not only is an author, but he's a practicing attorney. So it wasn't. I mean, you build your life. You still pursued the things you wanted. You accomplished a lot, and as you said, it all made you realize that, you know, being a father is a quite an important and yes, at times stressful job, but you do it 24/7. And I'm a father myself, and I can't imagine. You know, I can't imagine it being any different now. You know, it's funny, people say, "Well, we're expecting a child." Well, wait, it gets very interesting. But you know what? It is one of the most fulfilling experiences in anyone's life. Steve, in the book, you touch upon that there was, in a horrible sense, I guess, your biological father was involved in an accident, and you were on scene, right?
Yeah, I was the only witness. I was the only person there, and I was taking care of tennis courts. I worked at this tennis club in New Jersey. I was the only person on, even at the whole facility, on the 4th of July, which I still think is kind of strange, because it was the middle of the afternoon and I was sweeping these courts, and I hear a car like screeching, you know, squealing tires, burned rubber, that horrible smell. And all of a sudden, you know, boom, like this huge crash. And he hit a telephone pole, probably 50 to 100 feet, I'm not even sure, from where I was working. And I was a 16-year-old, and I'd never seen a car crash before, and especially one where a guy went through the windshield.
Ooh.
I ran up there, saw him, he was unconscious. I went, and I didn't know who it was. I ran to the payphone. Back then, there wasn't, like, cell phones, of course, and, you know, call the operator. It's like slow motion.
Yeah.
Like, it's like slow motion. You're like, did that really happen? Did I really see that? And then I wound up going back up there. By that time, police, ambulance come. They have him out against their car. And I can just feel him staring at me. Like, I just felt these eyes on me. And his face had been severely cut. Half of his eyelid was hanging. And, he's just in bad shape. And they pulled out his wallet and said, you know, does anybody know this man? And they pull out, they say his name, which is Alan Nessel. And I didn't say anything. I just got on my bike and yode home. My Schwinn Varsity 10-speed, I was very proud of it back then. 16 years old then, and I just drove home and acted like nothing happened and didn't tell anybody for 40 years that was my father.
Wow. But did you, at that moment, at the crash scene, did you realize then that he was indeed your biological father?
Well, when they pulled out his ID, you know, and said,
yeah,
this was his name. So that, plus just that whole feeling of, you could kind of feel there's just something going on. Like, I felt his eyes on me. Like, I just could feel this
connection,
tension like this. And on the side of the car, there was, it said, doctor of veterinary medicine. I saw that, like, all at the same time. So, but, you know, I just put it in my pocket and forgot about it. Like, tried to push it down and didn't tell anybody. And it was pretty crazy.
First of all, did he survive the accident? And secondly, was there any, did he reach out? Of course, did he understand that, you know, probably not, because he was probably, like you said, in rough shape, realizing that you were indeed his biological son was the one that made the call and was there on site?
He did later, like, he did survive. He's got like 200 stitches in his face and, you know, fractured ribs, and he was very lucky that survived. And, but I did later find out, because he kept journals, and after he died, and it's a whole other part of the story, all these journals, and wrote down almost everything that happened in his life virtually every day. He would sit down and type, and he was, I found out again, like, years later, that he was not just a veterinarian, but he was a very accomplished writer. And so he wrote all these things that I didn't know that he wrote, and not just journals or magazine articles and so forth. And in some of the personal journals that he kept, he wrote that exactly what happened, that he had hired an investigator to try to find us to get pictures, because he wasn't allowed to get pictures when he contacted my parents, and found out that I worked at these tennis club, and decided to take a drive by the courts. But before he did that, he took 3 or 4 Valium and a couple shots of vodka and got in the car and drove. And the crazy thing is when you read exactly what he wrote, he wrote, what a great movie, you know, a father dies trying to see his son. Like he writes all these things, and he does write that he looked up, you know, he describes it exactly as I described it, how, you know, the blood and the gore and what happened. And he looked up and, you know, through the haze, he saw, you know, he saw a teenage boy, and he writes like Steve ? So,
wow.
So he knew I was there. It's really, you know, people were all insane. I'm kind of insane. Maybe you're not, but like we all have life experiences that shape us, and who knows why people make decisions they do. But I was able to learn a lot about why he made the decisions he did, what was going on in his head. And one of the things that also happened is that I found out by reading his journals, and I actually confirmed this, was that he, after the crash and all that, and like I said, I went home went to my buddy's house, you know, was 16 years old. We, you know, probably went out and smoked some pot, and did, you know, we were kind of I never told anybody what I just witnessed. But years later, what I found out when I got all of his writing is that he had hit this telephone pole and it had damaged the property at the tennis club. And so the president of the tennis club wrote him a letter demanding, I think it was like $2,000 or $3,000 to repair the property damage that he had caused to the pole.
Yeah.
The president of the tennis club was my father, adopted father. My stepfather adopted me.
Wow.
So, yeah. And so they knew my father, who I lived with, who adopted me, and my mother knew that there had been this terrible accident with my biological father, but they never mentioned it to me.
Wow.
And they didn't know I had been there. And so my biological father decided that made him upset, of course. He got one of his employees, and again, this is all written in full detail, and I've confirmed this with the employee, and they went to the hardware store and bought 3 letters, ASN, those are his initials, and he made her take him over to the tennis courts where the pole was, because now he had to pay for the pole, and they nailed the letters.
Wow, what an amazing story. You know, unfortunately, I've heard of situations like this before, Steve, but yours is because how these pieces all fell in. Your stepfather ends up being the president of the club. Your biological father is the man who you basically rescued by calling the police and the emergency help. I mean, all those pieces falling together yes, as you said, could certainly be an amazing script for a best-selling movie. This is unbelievable. And I wish we had more time, because it just gets more intricate and it gets more interesting. That's why I hope people will go out and buy Pretend They Are Dead, because it really is. First and foremost, this is a true story of someone's life. And more importantly, as the story unfolds, and as you've been hearing Steve this evening, that it's just one amazing event after another. Steve, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you directly, pose questions, just find out more about you, how might they do that?
You know, StephenScottEichenblatt.com is an author's website I have set up. So you can track me down that way, or you can track me down through my law firm, Page and Eichenblatt in Orlando, Florida, EICHENBLATT. If you plug that in, you can find me. And listen, you know, I've had, even since I started talking about the book and doing some of the podcasts, I've had people call me with legal questions about family law or just questions about things. And I even got a message from someone who apparently my father had a sister that I was not aware of, who contacted me yesterday and said, I read your book, is amazing, and let me tell you who I am.
Wow.
So I've got like some really shocking, incredible responses. But you know, I'm always here to help anybody. And look, I'm a lawyer, but I can direct you to find help if you need it.
Yeah.
You know, parenting help, dysfunction. I've seen a lot of stuff.
Oh, I bet you have. I'm sure you have. But an amazing story, a true story of life, a loss and gains in some respect, but just a real personal story with some amazing turns within the book. So I would strongly urge listeners to go out and buy Pretend They Are Dead, A Father's Search for the Truth. My guest has been the author, Stephen Eichenblatt. Any questions about the broadcast? You can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.